Welcome to this Day One Podcast Extra, bringing you an in-depth conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One or to make a donation, please visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to this Day One Conversation. I'm Peter Wallace, and with me today is Diana Butler Bass. Diana is an author, speaker, scholar, specializing in American religion and culture. She's a senior fellow at the Cathedral College of the Washington National Cathedral. She has earned a PhD in religious studies from Duke. She's a frequent commentator in numerous media outlets. She's taught at a variety of schools, and the author of 7 books, including Christianity for the Rest of Us, which was named as one of the best religion books of the year by Publishers Weekly and Christian Century, and a new book, The People's History of Christianity, The Other Side of the Story. Thanks for talking with us, Diana.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter. I really am glad to be with you today. Thanks.
With all that background, what would you say is your mission statement in life?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it has become to live in hope and to help people proclaim hope. I would not have always said that. I suffered actually in my life quite a bit from depression. But over the years, as I have practiced my vocation as a historian, as a person who observes both the Christian past and the Christian present, there's been something that has grown inside of me, a vocation of telling stories that give people hope. And somehow in knowing and telling stories, I found hope and then have managed to somehow turn around and offer that to others. So now I claim that vocation, is that in the telling of stories, in the writing of good words, in the speaking of our faith, that there is a way of hopefulness for transformation for ourselves as individuals and for the world. So I have come to receive from the community that reads my words that I have a vocation of hope.
Well, and having heard you speak at the Festival of Homiletics, a very hopeful message to a group of people who are seeing a lot of decline in their denominations and so forth, and you've turned it around. We're going to get to that in a minute, but let me ask you about your spiritual journey, because you've had kind of an interesting journey. Tell us about where you ended up, where you started and where you ended up.
Where I started was a small Methodist church in Baltimore City, St. John's Methodist Church in the little suburban area of Hamilton in Baltimore. It was a congregation that my ancestors helped to found in 1904, and that several generations of my family were part of. And I was born there and baptized there in 1959. That congregation and some mid-century Methodism shaped me very strongly. And I still understand that in that congregation I first heard messages about social justice and transformation, and those things have stayed with me through all these years. But when in 1972, my parents left Maryland. They were distraught, like other people were, by all the changes that were going on in society, and they moved to Arizona. So they were part of, you know, frankly, it was white flight. You know, they went someplace where they felt like they could be safe and maybe recreate the patterns of the past. So we moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, which was sort of like the 1950s and the 1970s. It was not a very trendy sort of place. Barry Goldwater, you know, was the most popular politician there. And at that moment in my life, I was a young teenager, and my parents stopped going to church. They got us confirmed in the Methodist Church, and then they just stopped. So that left me at a pretty tender part of my own development, my own growing up, without any sort of guidance as to what to do with my religious life. And I became, I looked at a number of different options. I went to a Mormon congregation for a little while. I went to Roman Catholic masses with friends. I had a lot of friends that were Jewish. Attended some Native American rites and ceremonies. We lived right off of an Indian reservation. But wound up in a fundamentalist church. And so I had my requisite born-again experience when I was 15. And around a campfire in someone's backyard at a youth group meeting, singing the song, I Wish We'd All Been Ready.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that was a real popular, mm-hmm. you know, end time song in the 70s. So I was shaped then by the evangelical tradition of the 1970s and went to an evangelical college and seminary. And that tradition quickly proved not entirely satisfactory to me. So about 1980, I was in Europe with some friends. We were touring, and I went into an Anglican church, and it was at that little Eucharist in a Church of England congregation that I sort of reacquainted myself with historic Protestantism and came home from Europe, joined a local Episcopal congregation, and it's been for these last almost 30 years now, I can't believe it's been that long, that the Episcopal Church has framed my life. And so I consider myself a child of the main line who ventured afar and then came home to a different corner of the main line, but still very much part of the heritage churches of historic Protestantism.
I've heard you call yourself a contemporary historian. You're a historian, mm-hmm. but you're also looking at what's happening now and putting things in context. Mm-hmm. How would you say more about that?
Most historians, like, study the far past, and my specialty area when I was in graduate school was studying American religion. So I was never a historian mm-hmm. of the second century or medieval Christianity. I was always a historian who was doing fairly recent stuff within the last 200 years. So there's a level at which all my history is contemporary, at least mm-hmm. that's what my very traditional historian colleagues would always tell me. Oh, you people who study 19th century, you're studying journalism. That's not history. So there's always been, I think, that interest in me to look at the events of the more recent past rather than just the distant past. What my work has turned towards most recently is to take my tools of analysis and being able to read texts historically, and to try to take those skills and apply them to things that are going on around us. And to ask a question that is hard to ask, but I think it's an important question to ask. If I was standing 100 years from now, what story would I tell about Christianity in America in the year 2009? And to see if I can develop that kind of historical sensitivity to my own time by imagining myself in the future. So when I say I'm a historian of contemporary times, that's one of the things that I'm trying to do. Not just be a journalist, mm-hmm. not just sort of report the news ad hoc, but to give a more narrative, interpretive sensitivity to the telling of the story of our own times.
In your new book, you trace an alternative history of Christianity. First of all, set the context for us. How would you describe the standard history of Christianity?
There's been a lot of contention mm-hmm. over what a standard history of Christianity should look like in the last few years. And a lot of historians have rejected the idea that you could ever even tell the whole story of Christianity because it's too complex, that it's too, there are too many interest groups that have entered into the telling of the story, and they've given up the idea of writing a whole synthetic history. So there's that sort of group of historians. And then there are other historians who, I think, seeing the vacuum, have moved in and created what I would call triumphalist mm-hmm. sorts of histories. And that those have mostly come from the Christian right. You have a whole set of history textbooks that are used primarily in Christian schools that tell stories about how Christianity wins through time. And those are very influential, even though they might not make New York Times bestseller lists. There's this kind of undertow of these triumphalist stories in our culture. So I think that people have either given up on Christian history or they're telling it very badly. And so my attempt in my new book was to try to reach towards telling a bigger story, not give up on the attempt to tell a long tale, but to try to tell it in a way that was inclusive, that reached towards new methods of historiography and brought in the stories of people who have been excluded, and to stitch it together in a way that wasn't about triumph, but was rather about the simplicity of God's people living over time and trying to do, however imperfectly, what it was that Jesus asked them to do, loving God and loving their neighbor. So it's actually a project that has a big grand title of People's History of Christianity. It really has a rather humble purpose, simply to tell an alternative story and to give people a richer sense of living a Christian way of life. And that this can be done, because it has been done, by all kinds of people through time.
You call this kind of Christianity generative Christianity, which, did you coin that?
I'm not exactly sure if I coined it.
But you'll claim it. Explain that.
Yeah, I was looking around for a term to try to describe what I think is happening in Christianity today, and that there's so much contention over what form Christianity will take. And a lot of people think that conservative Christianity is the way of the future, or that evangelicalism is winning, or everyone's going to become a Pentecostal, or that Global South Christianity is the way to go. And so there's all these claims and counterclaims about different forms of faith, and I have never felt entirely comfortable with any of them. People, I think, mostly identify me as being more liberal or progressive. And there are ways in which I'm very comfortable with that label. That label certainly describes my politics, or it describes at least some of my theology. But there are other ways I'm not comfortable with it at all. If it means a disconnection from history, or if it means that I can't have a heart that's been strangely warmed by Jesus, you know, or that I can't even talk about Jesus, which is sort of a stereotype, I think, of liberals, is that we can't talk out of our hearts about God, about Christ. So there are ways in which I just violate the stereotype all the time. So I was actually looking for something to call myself as much as anything else. And I came to this word generative. And what it means for me is that there's, I think, a kind of Christianity that is being formed in the late 20th and early 21st century. That's a Christianity that emphasizes new birth and transformation, and that has as its heart the ability to generate new life and new possibilities where none previously existed. I actually think that President Obama talks about this kind of Christianity a good deal. And the people who want to sort of claim him, say, as a liberal Christian, are actually kind of a little baffled and disappointed at this moment, because he doesn't fit this sort of stereotypes of what old-style liberalism looks like. But instead, he talks about forming new communities, about creating post-partisan sort of policies. And I really think that the same impulse to go past the old liberal-conservative divide, to come up with new ways of connecting with one another, to finding common ground. I think that this is an impulse that's not just in our political sphere, but is also in our religious arena. And it's not just among Christians. I think that we're seeing this kind of generativity working itself out in some Islamic circles and Jewish circles, Buddhism. So I think there are elements of generative forms of spirituality and faith that are beginning to pop up in all the world's traditions. So I don't know that I coined it necessarily, but I use it.
I like it.
Thank you. And I have heard there's a group of younger Christian leaders who have been calling themselves regenerative. So, but I only heard of them after I wrote about it. So maybe it's catching on.
You mentioned in the book that you trace the history, this history, and focus on some of the people involved and what they did, how they lived it out. Can you give us some highlights, a few highlights of those people, maybe some that you weren't as aware of as you thought and learned something new about?
Yeah, I learned a lot when I was writing this book. And I took the focus off of institutions and off of doctrinal development or church politics or the big kinds of issues that we usually think of when we think of church history. And I took then I focused on people. And I asked myself, who are the people throughout the history of the faith who have given us some sort of wisdom about loving God and loving one's neighbor? Kind of almost the carriers of the wisdom of the golden rule, as it were. And some of those people are people that would be familiar to folks, even with a kind of cursory interest in history. I do talk about Luther and Calvin and Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. But then I talk about a whole host of sort of middling figures, people who some folks might know, like Hildegard of Bingen or Abelard and Heloise, or most people know Jonathan Edwards' name, but maybe don't know a whole lot about him. So talk about kind of that group of folks. But then I went as deep as I could go and tried to dig up people even I had never heard of. And I think that some of the people I was most fascinated by there was a group of women in Holland in the 1300s, and they were considered to be followers of the devout life, the Devotio Moderna. It was the new devotion. And it was a kind of a lay monasticism movement, mostly in the Low Countries. And none of the women that I write about in that section of the book are in any way, shape, or form famous. I never heard of any of them. But what the sisters in this one lay monastery had done is they'd written down their testimonies, and they gathered together this book. And a historian at Notre Dame has written extensively about these testimonies and translated them into English. And I went and I read them, and they were beautiful. One of the sisters was, I mean, she might sound a little wacky maybe today, but the people who lived with her talked about her kindness and how she would go into the public square in the little town in which they lived, and she would feed the birds and she would talk to them, and that she would tell them that she loved the loved them and she would be kind to these small creatures. And her sisters likened her to Saint Francis. And you know, when I read that testimony about this woman who in every circumstance in Western history might remain nameless, it showed me how deep there were these impulses in monasticism, that even this simple Dutch woman would reach back towards Saint Francis and try to emulate the life of poverty, simplicity, and love, and care for nature that he had had, and do it in her own life. And so that kind of person I do write about, and try to recover some sense of sacred memory around them. I also write about a couple of slaves, the Reverend Samuel Green, who has escaped slavery in Maryland and had a very dramatic story of witnessing to the Christian impulse towards freedom. I loved his story. And some of the Anabaptist women of the Reformation who willingly gave up their lives for a witness to peace. So there were a lot of people that were inspirational to me.
Hmm. Well, we're reading all sorts of studies and research these days, which are showing that the church is losing influence in the world today, not only the mainline church, but even the church generally speaking. Younger generations simply have no faith, or they're saying they're spiritual and not religious. But do you have hope for the church? You said you are, that is your mission, to bring hope. What needs to happen, do you see?
What I'd like to say about the future is that I am not what I would consider to be a sort of a cockeyed optimist. I recognize there's just enormous challenges in front of Christianity in its certainly in its institutional forms, the denominations, the formal organizations, its theological life. You can go down the list and see that there are troubling indications on all those levels about how successful the church can possibly be in the future. So I recognize all of those things, and I recognize that it will take enormous investment of imagination and a huge willingness to change to begin to address the problems that are facing Christianity on that level. So if you ask me about institutional faith, I can be a realist very easily about this. But I think the thing that always draws me are not the questions of will Christianity survive in its current institutional form. The answer to that question, I think, is clearly no. But what form will it survive in? Now, that's the question which I am more optimistic about. It is going through some shifts right now, and I think it will survive, and I think it will surprise us as it survives. I think that it is moving away from a belief-centered, sort of systematic, intellectual approach. Even Rick Warren has said this, you know, that the coming Reformation is about deeds and not creeds. And, you know, hey, if Rick Warren says it, I can say it too. But it's going to be more about practices. It's going to be more about Christianity as a way of life. It's going to be, I think, more concerned with the wholeness of human nature rather than just emphasizing sin versus goodness or the head versus the heart. I think that the coming Christianity is going to try to somehow enfold the complexity of human nature into understanding the stories that we've been gifted with out of sacred tradition. So I think it's going to be, it's anthropology, its doctrine of humanity will be rather different as we move ahead. And I also think that its understanding of God, its doctrine of God will be different. And for the last several hundred years at least, and maybe longer, Christians have argued about where God is. You know, is God in heaven? Is God in everything? Is God, it has become a question. And I think that one of the things that certainly I've been observing is that there's this new interest in the sort of the enfolding of the sacred and the secular. There's a not such a neat division as to where God is, that God is sort of everywhere, and then God is also completely other. And people are very comfortable in talking about the paradoxical nature of God and God's location, and don't see the tensions that previous sort of generations of Christian theologians did. So I think there's a kind of a sacredness within the world that is, and it's not just old-fashioned God is everywhere, but that it's real sacredness, it's real mystery, it's real divine otherness, an encounter with something that's beyond our words, but that it happens in the everyday. And that's a real different conception of God than what we've been working on in the West for the last 300 or 400 years. So I get excited about that. And as soon as you began to talk about a shift away from beliefs about towards practices, towards the constructing a meaningful way of life, and then you begin to look at these two things that are changing so radically in the Christian imagination, the doctrine of humanity and this understanding of the location of God. Just put those three things together, and I think we're looking at a very different picture of what Christianity could be like in the future. And I think it's I think these are good changes. I'm willing to lay aside the old arguments over creeds. I don't know how far they got us in understanding what it means to truly be Christian. And I'm also willing to recognize that we have a much more nuanced understanding of human nature, and we need to put that in relationship with divine story and come up with a new pathway for understanding ourselves in God. And I think that the visions of God that are beginning to emerge in Christianity and in Islam and in Buddhism and in Judaism are provocative and challenging and hopeful. And that combination of those three pieces just there makes me not a utopian or not a sort of, you know, like I say, sort of a cockeyed optimist, but a hopeful realist. That Christianity is going to thrive in the future. It will be different, but it has something to say about where we're going. And that makes me stay up at night and lets my imagination fly and be hopeful about the future. It makes me excited about wanting to see where all of this is going to go in 50 or 100 years. And think to myself, gosh, you know, my daughter is going to have some new rendering of this story that's going to be so exciting for her. And it's going to enable her to live and navigate the complexities of the future. And that's really what I want Christianity to be. I don't want it to be an antique little escape mechanism of nostalgia that protects people from the future, but can take them there with meaning and passion and with the love of Christ. And so that's why I'm hopeful, but realistically so.
Diana, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.